Hi folks, this is Tommy Emmanuel checking in with you. Check out young Chris here, and this is Walking the Floor. I'm walking the floor over you. There's Chris.
Yeah. I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you. Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to episode 185 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. Can you believe the pace that I am getting these things out right now? Once a week. Once a week. I haven't kept a once a week release schedule in years. It's like too much podcasting. I'm turning into a full-time podcaster, so as soon as I get through this COVID backlog of interviews, I'm gonna go back to every 2 weeks, but for right now, we're just flying because I got all these dusty interviews I got to get through, man. I'm holding the whole thing up. Can't get to the new ones with all these old ones clogging up the pipes, but they're good. So you know, I gotta just put my head down and get them out. And that's in the middle of like a very busy Foo Fighter schedule and busy family life and stuff. So yeah, I think really the question here is, is it too much content for you, the listener? Is once a week too much for you to keep up with? Because I know in the crowded podcast space these days, I know for my own listening, like, I just don't even listen to half the ones that I think I listen to anymore because there's just too much of it all the time. Just podcasts coming at you left and right. But anyway, it's good stuff. On another note, you know, I asked the question a few episodes ago, who was singing the second song in the Walking the Floor theme? Because I just couldn't place it, and it had been years since I'd put that thing together. And the internet has answered, so thank you. Yes, it's Vern Gosden, Set 'Em Up Joe, a classic song. I really should have known that. I hear you. Please stop tweeting at me and stop emailing me. I know it's Vern Gosden. I get it now. You can leave me alone. My apologies for not being able to figure that out on my own. Anyway, let's talk about something more fun. Let's talk about our good friends at Zounds.com, where did you know you get free shipping on every order with no exceptions and no exclusions? And it doesn't even matter if it's like really heavy stuff like tube amps or, you know, giant synth boards or drum kits or any of that hardware, whatever, you know, the mixing consoles, anything you get, man, free shipping on every order with our good buddies at Zounds.com. So if you need something, just get on over there and get it, man. And let's get to today's interview. All right, Tommy Emmanuel. Tommy Emmanuel, I like to think Tommy Emmanuel is one of those rare cats. It's like he's such a good guitar player that he can go out and have a career playing instrumental music. I mean, how many people do that nowadays? It's like almost nobody, but he's such a ripper and such a one of a kind that he's been able to carve out a career. I mean, he's done a lot of different things, session work. He has done, you know, had bands with vocals and all that kind of stuff and played electric and everything. But nowadays, he's mostly like an acoustic solo performer, and it's mostly instrumental stuff. And I think that is really impressive. And he's also part of the elite club known as the Chet Atkins Certified Guitar Players. There's not many of those, and no one else is getting in for obvious reasons. He's been doing like some live streams, and he's putting out records all the time. This is Tommy Emmanuel on Walking the Floor. How's it going in Nashville?
It's nice. It's sunny today, but it's cold, but it's sunny.
The streets haven't erupted into full-blown civil war yet. That's later. That's later tonight.
It comes later. Yeah. Tonight, exactly.
Yeah.
This is going to be interesting to see what happens today.
I know. It's funny, man. I didn't even really think about that when I was talking to your publicist the other day to schedule this thing that we were scheduling on this historic day of 2020 when it's all coming to a head.
Right. Well, that's the way it goes. It's, to me, it's a special day because it's my eldest daughter's birthday today.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah.
So you live in Nashville?
I do. I lived in San Jose for a little while.
Oh, okay.
But I ended up coming back here.
I played in a punk rock band from San Jose in the mid-1990s. So I spent a lot of time down in the Sunnyvale, Mountain View kind of area.
Right.
Yeah.
I was living in Campbell, right downtown kind of thing. It was nice.
Ah, Campbell. Campbell is well known as the home of Lars Fredriksson from the band Rancid. Kia, it's always talking about. Something tells me you two have never crossed paths, but you know, who knows? The music business.
Yeah. Exactly.
And when did you move up to the States?
18 years ago.
Oh wow! Okay.
But I've lived here before that. I lived in San Francisco in '95 for about 6 months.
I lived in San Francisco in '95. That's when I moved to San Francisco.
Well, I was living at Lafayette.
Okay. I lived across the street from, what was that place called? Plaza Foods. I was in the Western Edition.
Yeah.
Don't suppose we ever crossed paths on Haight Street going for a burrito.
Lots of good food there.
Oh, lots of good food.
San Francisco. Yeah.
And where'd you grow up in Australia? Where are you from down in Australia?
All over. When I was born, my father was working in a coal mine, and so we were there for a couple of years, and then we moved to a place. My father got a job with the government, and he worked on the soil conservation, and we started playing music there in 1959, and my mum was my first teacher, kind of thing. She showed me how to play chords and how to strum and how to tap my foot and how to feel time and stuff like that. She taught me so much.
You know, I was wondering, like, because, you know, I know Chet Atkins, of course, is a huge influence of yours. But when you were a kid growing up in Australia, was there a lot of American country music around? Like, was that popular there then?
Not as much as it is now. But I guess the things that we heard in those days were Hank Williams, Jimmy Rogers, Hank Snow, let's see, Jim Reeves.
Right.
It was most of the sort of poppy country that we heard on the radio. And then we had Australian country music, which was, you know, written by guys who had a pretty tough life. And most of the Australian country music was about characters and stories. It was all really story orientated.
I mean, for people listening that don't know, I mean, Australia is this huge landmass, and the vast majority of it is country.
Yeah, all around the coastline is where all the people are.
Right.
But there's a lot of desert, and there's a lot of dirt roads, and still kind of old-fashioned lifestyle out in the bush. That's the places where we as a family played. We went and lived way out in the middle of nowhere, and then we ended up where the Air Force is in a place called Darwin. And my father was in the Second World War, so he got the accommodation out at the Air Force. Out of where the Air Force were, and kind of they helped us out when we were broke. They helped us out with a place to stay and some food and some fuel.
And you guys had like a family band, right? Weren't you?
We did.
Like,
yeah, I was touring. The youngest.
Right.
There was my elder brother who's still with us, and then there was my elder sister who's no longer with us. And my elder brother, Phil, who passed away a couple of years ago. So we were a four-piece band. And we were unique because we didn't have a bass player. I covered the bass part, and I didn't know that's what I was doing. I just tried to make the music sound like I heard it on the record.
Right.
And so by some magical thing happening, I ended up I developed an ear for her picking up chords and playing bass with it and all that. And so I was sort of already doing part of what Chet Atkins was doing. I was already doing it unwittingly. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just looking to make the same sound as I heard on the radio or I heard on a record. And that's how I started finger picking and playing melody, bass, and chords at the same time.
Yeah.
And then when I heard Chet Atkins, I said, that's what I have to do. You know, I just knew it. That's what I was looking for. And he was doing everything I was trying to do.
I mean, that's really interesting because, you know, for people listening that don't know, like fingerstyle guitar playing, like Travis picking, Chet Atkins style, to me is like one of, if not the hardest styles of guitar playing. I mean, it's
totally self-contained.
Right. And it's very complicated. And it's almost like playing piano with, you know,
exactly.
Your hands are doing different things, but it's one hand and it's doing, you
know,
right.
The thumb is the left hand on the piano. Boom, boom.
Right.
Boom, boom.
It's hard to imagine that there were a lot of people that were playing that style where you were growing up. So I'm wondering if that sort of isolation was the thing that made you, because you do it maybe a little different than everybody else does it, you know, like from what I've seen, it's you know, mm-hmm. it's you know, you're obviously a master of it, but like the way that you'll sort of jump to using your thumb pick like it's a traditional pick and the sort of back and forth, and it's just sort of seamless. I was just wondering if the sort of isolation of being so sort of far away from the source was what sort of led you to just invent your own style with it.
Well, it could have been. I mean, I found a few of Chet's records. They were very hard to get, so that, you know, that they weren't everywhere. But I found some in my travels, and I wore them out, you know, listening to what he was doing. But I was already sort of halfway there with it. I had figured out some of the things, and I was trying to, you know, do a good job at playing that style. And it slowly developed until I was playing with a straight pick and with my fingers like that.
Right.
And then I saw a photo of Chet with a thumb pick on, and I went, ah, that's it, you know. So then I got myself a thumb pick and I was off to the races.
But was it as easy as just going down to the guitar store and getting a thumb pick? Or was that like how did you get your hands on the right stuff even at that point?
Well, There wasn't many music stores in the country areas. When we got into a decent sized city, we'd buy strings, picks, and stuff like that. And we were pretty isolated. But you know, I had my Chet records, and I also had a little plastic record player with where the speakers would fold up. And it would take batteries and stuff like that. I would buy a Chet Atkins record and we'd travel, and then we'd pull over to get some sleep, and I would get my record player out under the stars and listen to Chet Atkins, you know, while everybody slept.
I mean, that must have been amazing to eventually, I know that you got to know him and were friends with him. And,
yeah.
And we're even, you know, in his elite club of certified guitar players. So, I mean, I can only imagine that must have just been the realization of a kid's dream come true. What was that like for you?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, when I was 11 years old, I wrote him a letter and he wrote back. And we stayed in touch. And then when I was 18, a friend of mine sent him a tape of me playing without telling me. And next thing I get this handwritten letter in the mail from Chet saying, here's my office number, call me when you come to Nashville.
Really?
And I couldn't believe it, yeah. And so 7 years later, I got there in 1980, I made the pilgrimage. And I came here to Nashville. I was in LA to see Elton John at the Hollywood Bowl.
Mm.
And I saw Buddy Rich in New York City. So that was my musical intro.
You're just ticking all the boxes.
I'm ticking them all. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, but where were you sort of like, where was your, you know, your musical career at, like back home in Australia? Were you already well established?
I was pretty well recording. Established.
Okay.
Yeah, in Sydney, I was a studio player, and I played in bands as well. And so I had more work than I could handle, and there was so much work around in those days. And so I was playing in a kind of funky rock band, and sometimes I played drums in bands. Sometimes I played bass in a band. So I didn't just play guitar. I was proficient at drums and bass as well, and loved playing those instruments. So I always got a lot of work when it come to, you know, recording commercials, Coca-Cola commercials, McDonald's commercials, that kind
of
stuff.
Right, right.
And
is that why you went to go visit Chet in Nashville? Like, were you trying to go to Nashville to get session work or to make it as a solo artist? Like,
I went to see him because I felt it was my destiny to meet him. And I was right, because we became real close friends. And I lost my dad when I was 10. And so he and I had a lot in common. He had a difficult relationship with his father. His father didn't really recognize him, his father didn't support him very strongly. And it wasn't until he was, you know, rich and famous that his father came back into his life.
Right.
And we had that bond about our fathers, and that's what helped us get close. And I just stayed in touch. And then in 95, I came to Nashville as part of a Sony Music country music showcase for Australian artists. And I was like the token instrumentalist. All the other artists were singers, and you know, and so we did two nights at a place called the Ace of Clubs, and both nights they put me on first, which was great. Everyone was sober, and so I came out there and, you know, tried to hose them out as best I could, and Chet was in the audience with the people from Sony, or Columbia was the record company we were both with. And so he saw me live for the first time there, and he came backstage and told me how underwhelmed he was.
Underwhelmed?
No, he was having a joke. And then they came back and saw the next night. And about a week later, I was back home in Australia, and Chet rang me and he said, well, these Columbia people are pretty excited about us working together. Would you like to have a go at recording some stuff together? And I just couldn't believe it. And so I already had some songs, and I wrote another song when I hung up the phone from him. I ended up writing the song Mr. Guitar. Because that was his moniker, you know, that was his nick.
Sure.
And I always checked on people's records, you know, people like Jerry Reed or Ricky Skaggs or whoever. If nobody used that title, then I was going to have it.
Yeah.
So I ended up moving over and living at his house in the granny flat. And we hit it off and had a great time playing. And he was dealing with some cancer and stuff like that. He had cancer 5 times in his life. And it's a miracle he lived as long as he did.
Like, when you guys were playing together, were there moments where he, you know, showed you things? Like, were you such a Chet Atkins aficionado at that point that there was nothing more that he could teach you? Or were you still picking things up from him?
Oh, every day, all the time. I was begging and stealing and borrowing like crazy. No, but he knew, because him and I were the same when it comes to that. You know, he's like, show me how you do that. You know, can you teach me this? But he's just like always wanting to learn.
Yeah.
And so I remember one day I was playing Amazing Grace in the house, and he said, stop, I got something for you. Give me the guitar. And he showed me these chords, and I said, oh, my God, that's beautiful. It's so gospel sounding. He said, yeah, they're Ray Charles piano runs. the mojo sauce of the world, Ray Charles.
Of course. I mean, it's interesting because so often, you know, so often meeting your heroes can be awkward, but then trying to work with them is often, you know, problematic as well, you know, because it's like you love the guy or girl, but, you know, maybe when those moments where there's creative tension, it can be kind of strange. Well, so it's wonderful to hear that that wasn't the case.
No, it wasn't the case. And he was helpful all the time. And I know when we got into the kind of meat and potatoes of our album, Chet wasn't well, so I had to sort of take over the project, and I saw it through to the end. We did Chuck Ainley, who worked with Mark Knopfler. Chuck came and mixed the album with me, and he did a great job engineer-wise. He was so good. So I got the album finished for him, and then I played it to him, and he loved it. He was really thrilled.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, through the years, I mean, of course, people know that Chet Atkins was hugely successful as a record executive and, you know, one of the key architects of kind of the Nashville sound at a certain time. But was he active musically through all those years? I know that there was like the odd solo record here and there, but would he play on the records that he would produce? You know, was he in the mix musically that whole time?
Oh, totally. His music, you know, he made 105, I think, 105 albums. Chet recorded a lot. You know, I remember having that conversation with him where he'd say, you know, I've just been looking at my records and I can't believe I made so much music. How did I do that? You know?
That's a good feeling. How
did I do that? You know, and he said he would be so stressed sometimes because of record company stuff that he'd look down at his shoes when he got to the studio and there'd be one brown one and one black one. That's how
he just hadn't even noticed. That's amazing. You know, I gotta tell you, I've had the wonderful experience of recording my last couple solo records at RCA Studio A, which is, you know,
it's beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. I know you did some recording out there not too long ago. Dave Cobb for something. I don't remember what it was.
It was Barry Gibb's new album.
Right.
I played on one of my favorite songs, How Deep Is Your Love.
Did you guys know each other from Australia?
Yeah, not from Australia, but we were on the same shows in Australia. The Bee Gees were just like ahead of us. They were a little older and a little taller.
Probably not much taller, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, Barry's become a dear friend over the years, and him and his son Stephen and I, we're very close. And he's got some great product coming out, and I had a great opportunity to play on How Deep Is Your Love, and he let me come up with the whole introduction and the whole thing, and he really gave me a beautiful feature in that song.
You know, I was getting ready for this interview and I went back and listened to some of your early records, earlier solo records. I know you as the solo acoustic finger style, you know, player. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little ashamed to say, I didn't realize like a lot of those early solo records were loud, electric rock and roll guitar playing, you know, I didn't realize that that was part of your quiver. I mean, it makes sense. Obviously, as a musician, you probably play all kinds of different styles, regardless of the ones that we sort of know you better. But is that something you ever still dip into now?
When I get a chance to. But, yeah, you know, I mean, like I did a cruise last year with Buddy Guy and Joe Bonamassa and a whole bunch of blues players. And I did my solo stuff. And then I played and got up and jammed with Joe and his band, and he loaned me a beautiful old Fender twin amp, and I just used one of my tellies. Yeah, he's a great guy, but I mean, he's just so kind and so sweet. He really is.
He's got the most insane collection of gear maybe on the planet as well.
Yeah, he's the total nerd, you know.
So yeah,
that's good.
I was just wondering if there were ever moments where you just, you're like, fuck, I'm so sick of the acoustic. Let me just plug into something loud with some gain. Because it's so different, you know, it's such a different experience and dynamic.
I get a big sound from my acoustic playing. Mm. You know, I have my own sound man and my own lighting director. And, you know, the show is, everything is big. And it's nothing like, you know, this is just an acoustic show. It's going to be real quiet and blah, blah. Not on your life. It's as big as AC/DC.
Right. You
know, it's totally in your face.
Yeah.
Your head is inside my guitar when I'm playing live.
Which is no small feat, like for one guy with a guitar without a backing band.
You've got to have all the stuff done. The thing that I say to people, like when I'm teaching in places like Berkeley or MI, I always say, if you want to do what I'm doing, then you've got to be okay about being naked on stage.
Right.
Because everything is exposed.
Yeah.
On a giant level. When you get out there and play through a big PA and it's just you and the audience, everything's wide open and you're at your most vulnerable.
Well, especially with an acoustic instrument. I mean, you know, I mean, for those of us, you know, I'm mostly an electric guitar player, but, you know, and you can hide behind volume and gain and you know,
and
your phaser pedal and delay, whatever, you know, all that stuff. And it's interesting because, you know, a few years ago, I started doing a lot of solo acoustic shows myself, you know, on off nights on tour and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was such, it was really challenging for me.
I
can't say that I'm 100% comfortable with it even now. I love it and it's great and it's a whole different ball of wax, but I mean, it's what you just said about being exposed. That is the only thing that could be more exposed is to be like a stand-up comedian or something. That's like
right. I know what you mean. Yeah. Well, you know, it's what I so gravitated towards that. I had bands and I had some wonderful success in my home country. I got on TV. I was on TV all the time. And I had this great band. And what I used to do is I would play at a club that was like a, you know, 400-seater jazz club kind of thing, upstairs and downstairs. And I would open the show totally solo. And then the second set, I would play some acoustic, and then I switched to electric. Mm. And then the third set was pretty much all vocal with two really good singers. And we'd do stuff like Carry On My Wayward Son and What a Fool Believes, songs like that. So we'd play kind of pop music in the third set until we got to the blues, time for the blues towards the end. And so that people kept saying to me, the best part of your show is when you just play on your own. And people just said it all the time. And I took note of that.
Yeah.
And so I went out solo. And two things were great about that. One was that I could just do whatever I wanted. I didn't have to work to a list. I didn't have to have, you know, information for somebody else who needed it. I could just go out there and start playing and just make it all up.
Right.
And the other thing is that I kept all the money.
totally. Yeah, and you don't have to get hotel rooms for all these schmoes in your band. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, there is something really wonderful and liberating about being able to sort of stop on a dime when it's just you and just I'm going down this road, but now I'm going to go here, and you just there's nobody you need to communicate that to.
My lighting guy, Zach. I mean, he's one of the youngest members of my team. He's in his late 20s. And every night he's like, what are we starting with? And I'd say, we're going to do Mombasa. And he'd say, okay, good choice. And then I'd change my mind. I'd do something else.
Right.
And he'd always flash a light at me saying, you fooled me again, you know?
Yeah. Well, you got to keep them on your toes. Keep them on their toes. Yeah,
exactly.
So what, I know that you've got some live streams coming up that you're publishing.
Yeah, on Saturday.
Have you been doing much of that during this, this weird year?
Well, I started out this weird year back in California, and I was doing Facebook Live and Instagram Live. I was doing that. I was alternating those two formats. And then we decided that we could do something bigger and better, And so we're going to do this live interactive session, and it'll be two one-hour shows, one at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and one at 8 o'clock at night. And that should work with all the different time zones. We should be able to fit it into all the different time zones.
And when you say interactive, can you dive a little deeper into that? Because I did a bunch of live streams, like same kind of thing, Instagram live or whatever. You know, just sitting here in my little studio and play some songs or whatever. And it was fun, but really unnerving for me as a performer, because there's no applause.
You know, exactly.
Right? So have they figured out a workaround for that? Like, what's apparently, the interactive nature of what
when
you're
I
doing?
When I finish playing the song, they open the microphones and people can talk to me and people can interact with me. I don't know how it works. I've never seen it.
Oh, okay.
I'm told that that's what you can do.
Nice.
And people can be sitting, people can be right up close.
Right. Yeah. And isn't there something about like the faces being projected on the stage or something? Right.
Something like that. Yeah, I've got them all in front of me.
Nice.
So I can play to them that way.
The unnerving part of not having applause was maybe there was that, and then there was also like comments going by as you're playing. I'd start reading the comments and then I'd forget the song and what am I gonna be? You know what I mean? It was really confusing. But that's cool. That's interesting to hear. I'm curious to see how that works. Will there be hecklers at the live stream?
Probably.
Let's hope.
Heckle buds. Yeah.
Exactly. You know,
one of the big formulas for failure is trying to please everybody.
Oh yeah.
You'll run out of steam in no time.
Oh, yeah.
I remember, you know, I was telling this story to a bunch of young people about that it's because they asked me, do you read any comments or anything? Do you answer questions on your fan page? And I said, yes, I do. I read things personally and I try to get back to people and answer their questions. And so a guy wrote in on my forum when I played in Montreal, Canada, and he said, I wish Tommy would slow down a little and just maybe play a few more ballads. We really love his ballads. I wish he'd just slow down a bit. He's got too much energy up there, you know, just make it easy. So I took note of that. And the next time I was in Montreal, I opened with a ballad. And then, you know, and I talked a lot more. I sat down a bit more. I just made it a lot more kind of cozy and easy. And sure enough, the next day on the forum, the guy said, I don't know what's wrong with Tommy, but he just doesn't have the energy he needs to have.
And
that's what happens when you try to please everybody.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a really interesting topic, because there is there is that thing as an artist, as a creative person, you know, of course you want to follow your instincts.
Your instincts, exactly.
But it's always that fine line of like, am I being self-indulgent? You know what I mean? I don't know. I guess that's what a producer's for, you know?
Well, when I'm playing, I think like a producer anyway. I'm my own producer. And,
right.
I know how to get rid of anything that doesn't need to be there. You know, it's like it's all meat and potatoes, as I'm concerned. So, but, you know, I play certain songs to allow myself to stretch out musically. Yeah. Like when I play Guitar Boogie, you know, it's totally, I just quote the melody and then the rest of it is just all improvisation.
Right.
So, and I never play it twice the same, because I don't want to. I want to see what I come up with today when I go to play it tonight or whatever, you know.
I mean, I imagine that must be a big part of your fan base, wants to see you step out on the ledge with that. You
know, I always play way too much.
Right. That's what people want, I would think.
That's it. I mean, I walk this balance, right? So songs like Angelina, Mombasa, or ballads, a song like John Lennon's Imagine, you know, I would be faithful to it the whole way, because I have that much respect for John Lennon's writing. But you don't want to mess with something like that, or Somewhere Over the Rainbow, sure. You know?
Yeah.
You want to state the melody and hear the voice in your head. And so I do that. I have songs that I do not mess with at all. I just try to play to the best of my ability. And then there are other songs where I purposely, like if I did Merle Travis's Nine Pound Hammer, I'd probably do two or three key changes and improvise and just have some fun with it, you know?
Yeah.
So, and you know, a lot of times I'm very aware that this is all way too much, but people love it, you
right.
know?
Yeah. Well, especially in a live environment, you can feel when like the audience is starting to sag a little bit, you know, where to pick it up, where to slow it down, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, I haven't had any sagging audiences in a while. Thank heaven.
But
I know what
hopefully
you mean.
Hopefully soon. Yeah. You mentioned teaching a moment ago. Is that something you do much of?
I used to teach a lot. I had a lot of individual students back in the 70s. And then I started doing workshops in colleges and stuff. And when I moved here to America, they asked me if I would come and teach in Berkeley.
Mm.
And I did, and I loved it. It was just like a show, really. There's stuff I can play and demonstrate and point out what's going on to show young people how that's done. But in general, they ask me, especially in Berkeley, they ask you, you know, what are you thinking when you're doing this?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm looking for something good to play.
Well, here's the question for people wanting to learn Travis picking finger style, you know, that style of guitar playing. Mm-hmm. What is, because like I said before, it is crazy hard. What's the starting point? What do you recommend as the start? What's the song or the lick or the what? What is the starting point to go down
there? The starting point is to learn some easy and good songs. The songs will get you playing. You need to work out how to go boom chick boom chick boom chick with your thumb, which is the left hand of the piano.
Yeah.
Get that going, and then bring the fingers in. But you've got to have some songs to play. You know, you're going to get bored in 3 minutes if you're just playing chords.
Right.
You need songs. So keep the song simple. Freight Train, number one song to learn in fingerstyle. Windy and Warm. Wheels. These are old songs from the 50s, but they're great fun and challenging to play. So start with that. Start with a bunch of songs and listen to Chet, Merle, Jerry Reed, you know, all those guys. They're the guys to listen to get good ideas.
Sure. Jerry Reed, a master.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Hey, one last question, then I'll let you go. And it's required that I ask anybody from Australia that comes on the show.
Yeah.
Do you surf?
Do I surf?
Yes.
I body surf.
Okay, well, close enough. Yeah,
I don't
riding waves.
I
love it.
I never was interested in surfing on a surfboard, but I love body surfing.
Nice. What's your favorite beach back home?
It's called Mission Beach.
Where's that?
In Western Australia.
Okay. I love the northern beaches up north of Sydney.
Oh, yeah.
I love that stretch of coast.
They're incredible.
Oh,
yeah, it's gorgeous.
My favorite. Yeah, love it.
Yeah, if only I was a multi-millionaire, I could afford to live there.
After this podcast comes out.
Look out.
You're there, babe. You're there.
Thank you.
Hey, Tommy, thank you so much for coming and doing this today. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
You too, brother. Hopefully I'll see you in Los Angeles sometime.
For sure, and good luck with your streams.
All right, brother.
All right, that was Tommy Emmanuel on Walking the Floor. God, that's kind of a trip. I forgot until I listened back to that interview that I interviewed him on Election Day 2020. And it was kind of funny how obviously there was no way of knowing at that time that the, I think I referenced like, you know, rioting in the streets, and that wasn't, of course, to come for a couple months till later. But yeah, what the hell did we know? Anyway, Tommy Emmanuel on Walking the Floor, go check him out, go check out whatever he's up to, and I will be back with another episode in 1 week, kids. 1 week, whether you like it or not. All right, adios, amigos!